maintain the trajectory we're seeing with China right now and really do more of the value-added manufacturing, then we are not only going to create jobs and create a better society for African countries, we are also going to be able to even build a better relationship with China, because China has a very huge market, a burgeoning middle class with huge appetite for some of our brands. So if we can export to other markets even more, and even allow us to export into other markets, you know, as well.
Hello and welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast, where we throw light on some of the African continent's biggest and most pressing issues and leverage best practice, not just on what to do, but how to do it. I'm your host, Marino Ongokulo, and it's a pleasure to share in this moment with you. If you're new here, welcome. It's nice to have you here. If you're a regular, hey, how's it going? So this is the podcast where I share a lot of the super interesting conversations I have with really cool people. I'm a firm believer in sharing ideas that shape and challenge the world as we know it. My hope is that these conversations, where you get to be a fly on the wall, start further and deeper conversations wherever you are and lead to the exploring of actions and ideas that actually work and make a difference. So without further ado, let's get straight into it. Again, I'm Marie Noel and you're listening to the Brentas Foundation podcast. So recently, I spoke to Hannah and Jade from Development Reimagined. If you've not listened to that episode, you definitely should go back to that. It's about 3 episodes up. And that conversation started so many for me, so I thought, why not delve deeper and get a bit more insight into this Sino-Africa relationship and how that's evolving, especially around trade and infrastructure, as well as security. In today's chat, I have with me Ovigwe Igwegu. Ovigwe is an analyst with a special focus on geopolitics, diplomacy, and international institutions. His thematic areas of expertise include African Union, Africa-China relations, and he's frequently been quoted in many news media, including Al Jazeera, CNN, Bloomberg, BBC Radio, DW News, you name it. Ovigwe's work focuses on policy-oriented study of Chinese foreign policy and the relations between China and African countries, as well as China and the AU as an entity, deepening the understanding of how Africa as a complex set of actors relates with China and how China's development and evolving global role is likely to impact the future of Africa. He's adept at critically analyzing the politics of contemporary development processes and geopolitical interests that influence them, and he does exactly that in this chat. And yes, it is that time to transition to this all too important conversation with Ovigwe. Let's listen in.
All right. So Ovigwe, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm excited to have you here. To get us warmed up though, I thought we could engage in, you know, a very quick short game to familiarize the audience with who you are. Are you ready to play?
Of course.
Okay. So how many languages do you speak?
Wow, that was a question that I like to answer, but at the same time, I'm always like very skeptical about what people think. You know, people think about. But anyway, I speak English. That's for starters, of course. As obviously, that's language we're communicating in, and then Pidgin English actually. So that's the only two. Yeah, that has to count because that's language where I come from in Nigeria, southern Nigeria, not just southern Nigeria, from Delta State. Delta State is like the center of Pidgin English in Nigeria. So that's where, that's really the mother tongue, you know, that we grew up, you know, speaking.
Yeah.
Except in school where we learn formal English because we're educated in English. So I would say a bit of my local dialect, which is called Okwe, and then English and Pidgin English, because I have to count that. That's really the main language.
Oh, it definitely counts. Those are 3 solid languages there. Yeah. Like, I'm with you on the front, so fear not. All right. What was the first job on your resume or CV?
Okay, so I did train as an optometrist, right? So after secondary school, I went on to my parents wanted to be a doctor, so I went on to optometry school, then finished the CCH program, and then went on to practice for 5 years actually. Yeah, so for 5 years I was a clinician, yeah. Practice in Lagos, Nigeria's biggest city, and then moved to Abuja. When I was making transition into international affairs, I just figured, of course, Lagos is a place known for entertainment and the, you know, fashion and Nollywood, you know, but Abuja is more the business, not necessarily business, rather more the business of international affairs, if I could phrase it like that. So that just made me move to Abuja because, I mean, this is where my own sector really is in the country, as opposed to where in Lagos as the more of the commercial entertainment, you know, industry. Yeah. So my first job was really for 5 years straight was, you know, optometrist, you know, at a clinic, and then also actually was moving up the ranks. I got to practice manager at my last year before I left. Yeah. So.
I wish people could actually see my face. So unfortunately, this is just like an audio podcast, but what? I did not see that one coming like a mile away. And practice. It's not like, oh, I just went to school and then I changed. No. I practiced.
I'm published in academic journals as well.
Wow. Well, that's remarkable. Kudos to you. Oh, I'll be keen to hear more of that in another chat. Okay. So what best describes your work day now, I guess, in this life?
Yeah, well, my work day really starts quite early because, you know, considering I work with the Dr. Imagine and we have our headquarters in China, so we work with Beijing time, right? So when it's like 6 o'clock in the morning, I'm already up, you know, really looking at news, what's breaking in China, you know, and all of that. Sometimes even earlier, because you have to be, you know, up and ready. And then for me, it's going through the news at about 6 o'clock in the morning, oftentimes. And then a bit of catching up with some colleagues on projects, you know, that we're working on. And almost all the time that leads to maybe one podcast or interview. Like, for instance, today I just finished an interview with TRT World, discussing the situation in West Africa, that Mali and the G5 Sahel force. So it's usually that, and then that's usually how my morning goes. So wake up, go catch up on what's happening on the continent, what's happening in China, and then meeting with colleagues, and then interviews or, you know, podcasts. Yeah,
like that. Oh wow, okay, that's awesome. Question for you: what's one skill that, let's say, you underestimated maybe, but has served you really well at work?
Oh yeah, that's really, really interesting. I would say, without thinking twice, it's my ability to actually not react to, you know, criticism or anything. I don't react. I always have this ability to actually listen to what someone is saying about me or work or where I work and all of that, and then instead of reacting, you know, compulsively, I have always had the ability to actually, you know, listen carefully and then respond consciously. And even when I was growing up, you know, I got into trouble because most of the time it's people's, you know, maybe their nerves are, you know, afraid or stepped on their toes, and then immediately they just, you know, respond and they could do something, and at least, you know, maybe fight and all of that. But I've always been very good at that. So coming to international affairs and then writing articles and sharing opinion on very thorny issues, really exposed, you know, so it's no longer your peer group in your small town, right? It's not the world when you put something on LinkedIn or something on Twitter or write an article that gets published in a major platform. And then for the next 1 week, sometimes in my DMs is one person giving their take or their response, and it could just be most often than not, it's actually positive. But of course, I always look out for the critics and for even the negative one, because you really want to know, you know, and assess your own self. You know, so. Yeah. And sometimes some people can get really, you know, really nasty. But yeah, it doesn't really get to me, because thankfully, and I was blessed with that capacity or that mental attitude from a very young age. So that's really served me well.
Wow, no, that's amazing. That's definitely a good skill to have because I'm like, people, we just have to have thick skin in this space, you know?
Yeah,
and also
that's true.
like enough to not like doubt your own, like you're like, wait, am I? Yeah, but no, it definitely is a skill to have, and I'm definitely learning to wear that quite well. Okay, last question for you. What comes to mind when you hear Africa in 2050?
How are we going to feed these people?
Good question.
Yeah, because if we look at the projection, you know, of the continent population projection, we're expected to be about 2.4 billion people, right, by 2050. And 2050 is less than 30 years away.
Yep.
That means between now and 2050, we have to increase at a very ridiculous pace our agricultural productivity. We have to increase our capacity to create jobs. We have to increase our ability to ensure that these people are educated, you know, because if we miss all of these you know, issues and do not really address them, 2050 is going to be a very challenging time in terms of security, because when you have so many young people who are not very well educated, who are hungry and not fed, yeah, and who are out of work, your defense budget is going to swallow all the revenue, because you have to be able to fight crime and fight all of that. So for me, the first thing that comes to mind is, how are we going to feed, clothe, you know, and educate the population at that time? Because we have an opportunity to actually turn that democratic dividend, you know, into real, you know, to pivot our economies forward. If we miss it, then democratic dividend becomes, you know, almost like a democratic demographic doom, rather.
Yeah. Indeed, here, I agree with you. And in terms of the current trajectory, how hopeful are you of us being able to avoid the doom?
Actually, very hopeful. So, by the concerns about terrorism in the Sahel, you know, intractable conflicts in DRC and Central Africa, even some parts of East Africa, and then all of the security issues we're facing, issue about development finance to actually invest in our economies and build infrastructure. I think at the same time, we're also blessed with a generation of Africans that, in my opinion, in my very short time on earth, I have never seen a more clear, you know, pool of intellectuals and experts and analysts on this continent. So what we have right now, and the intellectual capacity, the scope of expertise that the continent has in its people, means every of our problem can be solved by this generation. And then we're also empowered with technology and new and growing partnerships, you know, with countries all over the world, in the Western countries, China, India, you know, even Turkey. So there is so much going for us. And that's why I'm actually very, very optimistic that we'll be able to overcome these challenges if we can summon the courage and conviction, you know, to do the hard work, you know, make necessary sacrifices, and I think, and you know, really set the content in a very, you know, very solid trajectory.
Yeah, no, awesome, and thank you so much for being open to engaging on this. For a second, I almost forgot. I was like, I think we're into the episode already, but I was like, wait, this is meant to be the intro. No, this has been great. So thank you. But I think, going off of what you're talking about already, in terms of, you know, this Sino-Africa relations, right? Especially some of the commitments that have been made recently. Can you help me paint a picture, however broad you may want it to be, of what that looks like, especially when it comes to trade infrastructure and even security, what that looks like today and where the priorities are for these two, you know, I would call them both heavyweight champions, but somebody might disagree.
Yeah. So if we look at trade, for instance, you know, trade between Africa and China, you know, rose to record high, I think, 2021.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you look at the figure, the volume of trade between Africa and China was about 35% increase from 2020 to 2021. And it's currently at $254 billion, you know, dollars last. And that's a huge, huge growth. And that's the kind of that was, first of all, that was unexpected. Or that was, a lot of people thought because of the pandemic,
yeah,
and the slowdown in, you know, global trade, you know, manufacturing in China, that we'll definitely be seeing, you know, a very gloomy outlook for considerable future, right? But
yeah,
very quickly, you know, there was a huge bounce from 2020 to 2021, and we got that, you know, that massive 254 billion in terms of value. For me, that trade is very important. That figure is very important because one of the major things we've been doing at, you know, the consultancy I work is that we're trying to really make the case that development aid, which is to be like the major vehicle in terms of development cooperation between African countries and Western counterparts, needs to change, and that aid is just a tool in the toolkits,
right,
of, you know, mechanisms you can use in development partnership. And one of our favorites is trade, because trade creates jobs, trade leads to transfer of skills, leads to transfer of technology. It really taps into the potential of a society the way almost nothing else does, or no other pillar does. So for us, and see that those trade figures is also very, very gratifying, because we also have been pushing both on the African side and on the Chinese side to increase, you know, trade cooperation. You know, whether it's driven by investment into sectors like agriculture, or even fintech, even the good old, extractive industries. But one of the major areas where we've been very vocal and where we've tried to really put emphasis, it's in value-added manufacturing, right? Mm-hmm. Because we believe value-added manufacturing is the solution to many of Africa's problems, whether it's industrialization, you know, or even the ability of it to create jobs. So for us, the trajectory, if we maintain the trajectory we're seeing with China right now, and really do more of the value-added manufacturing, then we are not only going to create jobs and create a better society for African countries, we're also going to be able to even build a better relationship with China, because China has a very huge market,
yeah,
a burgeoning middle class with huge appetite for some of our brands. So if we can export into other markets even more, and even allow us to export into other markets, you know, as well. So that's a very, very key thing for us. But I like the fact that you mentioned infrastructure, because infrastructure is one of the major challenges African countries are facing. And the infrastructure in the sense here is the hard infrastructure, that's one of them, because, for instance, we've created the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, right? And I like to think of AFCFTA as the soft infrastructure, because it's really the norms and the rules and removing the non-tariff barriers and creating some form of a policy regulation to ensure that trade becomes more profitable by creating a larger market. But if you have, you know, cocoa grown in Cote d'Ivoire or in Ghana, and you've even done the work like the Ghanaian government and the Ivorian government is trying to do the manufacturing of chocolate in there, but the demand in Nigeria, or the demand in South Africa, or the demand in Kenya for that chocolate is there, how do you take that product, or you have to have infrastructure to take that chocolate from Ghana to, you know, the market in Nigeria or the market in South Africa, you know, and the likes. So that is why the hard infrastructure for us is very, very important. And we really believe that without having that infrastructure, you know, rail, ports, you know, to facilitate trade, it's going to be very difficult for the AFCFT to really deliver on the promises of, you know, of industrialization and all of that. So another major issue, I like also the fact that you mentioned security. Now, if you look at this insecurity we have in the Sahel, using the same example of chocolate, you want to export chocolate to Morocco or where Ethiopia, and then instead of going all the way down south via shipping routes, you want to build a railway from Accra or from northern Ghana to Addis Ababa. You know, you have to cross through one of the most dangerous parts of the world right now, which is the Sahel. So with the Sahel belt and building infrastructure across, that's not going to be very, very easy. That railway is going to be prone to attacks over and over again. Even our country here, Nigeria, we're seeing what is happening with, you know, attack on railway, even within, you know, the country. Mm-hmm. So that underscores the importance of having security partnerships while we are building and investing so much in infrastructure to ensure that we have the partnerships to create a more conducive environment, you know, a safer environment for our infrastructure, so that we don't spend money on needless repairs and even expensive infrastructure projects, you know, that you need not spend that amount of money for. For example, Nigeria wants to export gas, you know, to Europe now. It's thinking about a 7,000-kilometer gas pipeline from Nigeria through West Africa, 11 West African countries, to Morocco, right? But you could build a pipeline through across from Nigeria straight to Morocco through the Sahel. Again, the security risks of the Sahel, the pipeline being bombed by, you know, Al-Qaeda, Islamic Maghreb, and all of Boko Haram and ISWAP, is one of the major challenges that the countries are facing. So you're having to go through, you know, another route, or even if that route, yes, is still profitable, but multiple routes for infrastructure, the more the merrier for this type of, you know, things. You can reach more markets, you know. So that's why this is a time where we have to think very holistically. So when we're pursuing trade, we have to, and creating the instruments and all of that for trade, we also have to create the hard infrastructure as well to do that, and also create the security environment to ensure that these investments deliver on their returns without, you know, unnecessary, you know, disruption from insecurity.
No, thank you for painting that picture for me. And it sort of stirred a whole bunch of questions. One of them is when it comes to trade, for instance, right? You mentioned the importance of like value added manufacturing, and because it can create jobs and all these things. And I was just wondering, because if we look at the balance, right, for instance, I think Africa possibly accounts for, you know, like less than 4% of the global trade with China. But if we look at it the other way, it's the balance is a bit wonky. So I'm just wondering, like, how does that come up in some of these conversations, and how should we be having these conversations so that we also can build, we also can increase the percent that goes out there? And I guess the secondary question is, and I know it's not exactly, you know, China's responsibility to do this, but in some of these conversations, thinking about, you know, mutual growth and mutual trade benefits, are there particular efforts being made towards, you know, helping African countries, a lot of whom are on this mission to industrialization?
Yes. So I like the fact that you mentioned that the responsibility is actually on African government, because that is really where the responsibility lies. But there's also the political will from your trading partners to listen to those and suggestions and your vision for your own trade growth and improving your trade. So when it comes to what one of the areas of cooperation between Africa and China in terms of industrialization, I would say the special economic zones are like the flagship, right? So particularly the one you have in Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. So we've seen so much Chinese investment go into special economic zone in Ethiopia, and we're seeing the manufacturing in areas of textile, you know, and some household, consumables. And that's creating a lot of jobs. That is also giving new impetus to, you know, to Africa's industrialization agenda, right? Mm-hmm. But one of the major, or I say two of the major issue areas where I see a lot of challenge in our development or in our industrialization is cost of food, right, and energy. Now, cost of food, because Ethiopia was able to bring down labor costs and be able to create the kind of work for the price point you are going to pay for labor because of the cost of food. Because once people pay so much for food, then that's like most primary fuel that the people need, that the labor cost is going to be very, very high. And we need to be very competitive at that particular price point because we have so much competition from Asian countries. So who have better infrastructure. So to say you have the labor cost advantage means you want to look at particular areas where you can actually keep that low without necessarily having like a slave-like mental a work environment, right? So for us to do that, we have to invest a lot in agriculture and ensuring that we can keep cost of food really low, and that will support the cost that will be going into that workers will be charging for their labor. That's one. And then energy. An energy deficit economy can never industrialize. I mean, power is what powers economy, right? So if we do not have a proper conversation around the base, you know, base load of our industries or of our economies, ensure that our economies can actually power the development, then we're not even having the right conversation. Yeah. So if the enthusiasm we see and the commitment we see in Ethiopia towards its dam is because you understand that without energy, it cannot be able to power the industries that we're talking about when we speak of industrialization. So within the China-Africa space, like I said, we've seen those coming from special economic zones. Even in our country, Nigeria, there's one in Lagos as well. So another one in Ogun. So we need this type of special economic zones to be able to pilot manufacturing, particularly for low-cost manufacturing that creates labor intensive, but also, like I said, very energy demanding as well. So we mm-hmm. should be able to create the energy to ensure that the cost of production is very, very low. Because if you're running on diesel in your factory, we're doing a lot of work around getting Chinese investors to come to the continent and see where they can manufacture. And then a country like Nigeria, over 200 million people, massive population, young population, can work fairly well educated and can do a lot of the can compete in terms of manufacturing. And then you're telling the investor that they still need maybe 4-5 different diesel generators, with a liter of diesel being about $1.72 right now, and telling that he has to put that cost into the manufacturing. Of course, you have problems because he's going to look at the next country, maybe Ghana or Senegal or anywhere else where you have power. It doesn't have to do with the power problem. But even when you are going to the countries that don't have power problem, the question that becomes: do they have Nigeria population and the manufacturing capacity in other sectors? So one of the problems we have in the continent is you have some countries who may have the kind of regulatory framework that could help Africa, could incentivize investors to build factories.
Yeah.
But they don't have the manpower. Those who have the manpower and the regulatory framework, might not be energy poor. Those who are energy rich might not have the regulatory framework. We have to do a lot of work in terms of creating, at the national level to do our homework and creating all the necessary conditions for right. industrialization, and then also working with the AFCFTA, harmonizing all of our national development strategies into feeding off the AFCFTA and to really access other markets, whether in Europe and North America. So beyond infrastructure, beyond the soft infrastructure and hard infrastructure to improve our trade exports, is also the question of market access, because you might want to produce, but the market in Europe might not want your product. So we also need to talk about our other partners, like I said, in Europe and also in North America, to be able to create more opening for African products, whether it's free trade agreements, whether it's for those who can compete, whether it's preferences, preferences for certain economies or certain commodities to come into the market. You know, we need those type of arrangements with as many countries as possible, particularly the big markets, Europe, North America, and China.
No, thank you for that. The one thing that came to mind, though, even in terms of conversations around AFTA and harmonizing, you know, sort of our policies, our national level strategies into something that can operate at a continental level. One of the concerns have been with, you know, with a huge country like China, for instance.
Yeah.
How do we manage, for instance, like a situation where, you know, China is sort of ahead of the game, and so can produce a lot of these things at a lower price point than we can. I mean, I know wages are rising on that side as well, but
yeah.
How do we avoid a situation where we just end up, you know, being flooded with goods from that side, and then it undermines the industrial or the manufacturing capacity that some countries are looking to build? I know this is a conversation that comes up a lot, so I'll be curious to hear what your thoughts are on managing that dynamic.
Yes, it does really come up a lot, because and you said it really well. We're not on many areas. We're still not as competitive as we ought to be. So that's why even when we're looking at our trade agreements with China, at least China was able to have a future agreement with Mauritius. That's going to be an example for many African countries to look at in terms of how Mauritius is going to fare in its cooperation with China. So we need free trade agreement with China. So one of the main things we have to do is always make our case for our Chinese counterparts to know, at the level of our development, this is where we have certain advantages, and of course we have certain vulnerabilities. So even if you are making this free trade agreement, they really need to take into cognizance the context, you know, under which these countries are collaborating. So, for instance, if you look at in 2020 December, there was a MOU signed between China and the African Union, specifically linking the Belt and Road Initiative and the AFCFTA, because we understand they are complementary in certain areas. Belt and Road Initiative is very big on infrastructure and connecting countries among themselves, and of course with China as well. And we need those infrastructure, right, to connect our countries. But at the same time, we also need within our cooperation framework to make a very strong case, you know, for Africa, context. We cannot just open our we should be able to open our. I mean, that's what free trade agreement would be. Mean open your market to me, I'll open my market to you. But we're not at the same level of competitiveness. And it is going to be very important for African countries to be able to find their footing in such a very competitive, market. So one way to do that is, yes, maybe the Chinese exports and still very competitive, but yes, you mentioned the cost of labor is going up in China. They are even offshoring some of those low cost manufacturing, out, for instance, to Vietnam, and that's also an opportunity for us. So even if they might still defeat Africa in certain categories, when it comes to the real low-cost manufacturing, we can make a strong case for our own industry, for particularly the countries that are very, very competitive, like I just mentioned, in terms of that labor, Ethiopia and other countries like Nigeria should really to strive to see how they can edge out the competition as well. Even not just export back to China, but at least for within our own markets, yeah, as well, and as much we can get from other parts of the world, Europe and North America.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. And even on this topic of infrastructure, right? I think I was reading, I think it was like the Boston University's Global Development Policy Center, and it basically showed that, you know, in terms of like Chinese state financing for major infrastructure projects, yeah, Think over the last couple of years, and even at the recent like FOCAC, you know, summit, if I can call it that, it seems that it's a bit of a move away from this, like, you know, hard cash, hard infrastructure to more like softer cooperation. What do you make, and I think I remember in the conversation with Jade, I think it was this idea that it's not necessarily a rollback, but rather I'm putting in my own words, like a pivot. You tell a bit about why, like, that is, why the move away from, you know, heavy infrastructure to sort of more softer points of cooperation around trade and around providing, you know, financing or even SMEs.
Yeah. Okay. So, if you look at what we had at FOCAC, 40 billion, that financing was still there. And then a lot of people saw as a reduction from the usual 60 billion African countries that we're getting. Mm. But what is also still missing is the mention of projects. So we had, for example, 10 poverty reduction projects, 10 regional connectivity projects. Mm. We don't know what the financing package for those projects would be. So we might end up having a situation where you are getting even more than the 60 billion that we've been used to. But yes, what you're mentioning now is about the pivot towards, you know, so-called softer areas of cooperation. Yeah. It's actually because of certain, you know, realities. One, one of the problems with the big, you know, infrastructure financing. And suspicion is that, yes, given the global economic situation, China, of course, slowed a little bit because of the COVID-19 pandemic. There's also concern about the sustainability of African countries, given global slowdown of the economy. So the economy is global, is not growing. The ability of this country to pay back the loan reduces, right? But if you then invest in trade, invest in all of in the countries, other areas where there's a lot of potential for growth, then these countries within themselves would have a kind of economic vibrance to do more PPPs, which is public-private partnerships, which is evolving to be the new and the preferred way of cooperation right now in terms of infrastructure financing. So it removes a lot of the concerns around public debt and sustainability, and puts a lot of the burden on the economy's ability to create the wealth to fund this, infrastructure. So, for example, the Nairobi Expressway that is being commissioned, I think just commissioned or will soon be commissioned, is a good example of the kind of dynamic we are going to see going forward. Because if you have a vibrant Kenyan economy, people will be able to pay the tolls because they have jobs to go to, because you have, you know, and then the tolls, then over a period of time, you use that to pay, for the infrastructure, or you're doing the BOT, build, operate, and transfer, and then you transfer back to the government or the state later on. So I think with infrastructure, yes, the big, large concessional financing has reduced, but if you listen closely to what Ambassador Wu Peng, who is the Director of Africa Affairs at China Ministry of Foreign Affairs, is saying, is the commitment to concessional financing is still there. So it's not as if China is not going to be doing those type of things anymore. But we're at the point where, given the global economic climate, it is more feasible short term to focus more on, you know, other financing mechanisms that take into cognizance, you know, concerns about sustainability of debt, technical cognizance, areas where there's growth potential, and we can actually leverage all of that, you know, to continue our infrastructure cooperation going forward.
No, thank you for that, and I'm really glad that you brought these up and are providing sort of a balanced view on them, because there are so many ways to think about it. But I think one thing that you've also made clear, which I really appreciate, is the onus doesn't exactly fall on just, you know, for instance, China, although they have a role to play, and a pretty big one given sort of their size and their weight, but also on us and also on African leaders in terms of what we want when we go to the table, what exactly it is that we hope to achieve, how do we hope to achieve it, and how can we use outside help to get where we want, and not necessarily let just outsiders, if I can call it that, dictate or navigate how we go about achieving, you know, certain developmental objectives. I think one last question I wanted to ask you is, in terms of some of the commitments that came out of FOCAC, for instance, I think one of them was even, you know, some commitments to improve like the competitiveness of agricultural products. But there were also some interesting ones around sort of like credit lines or financing to SMMEs. I think that's a slightly different approach, and it's one that is pretty helpful. It's pretty good because we do want to help like local businesses. How much has been done on that, I guess, since that announcement is the question that I want to ask. Are you aware of developments in that space, or how they're hoping to carry out on some of these, you know, grand statements that were made?
Yeah, was just studying that closely with a lot of enthusiasm, because that is one area where we believe there's a lot of growth potential, because you have so many young entrepreneurial Africans who can really process some of, you know, the raw materials, you know, around there, whether it's in the agricultural sector, whether it's in you know, textile, or even fintech, you know, to put one and two together to create brands, to create businesses, to create products that people need and there's demand for and can pay for. So there's a lot of expectation that we would see a lot of financing go in this area, because they will believe there's a lot of potential, you know, in them. I haven't myself heard of any major announcement on that front. Except I'll have to check and get back to you, you know, on that. And mind you, one of the reasons why there is such, you know, I would say not necessarily slow pace with regards to all of this now, is once you are together with all of this commitment, particularly the private sector commitment, is once you are not dealing with the private investors, no longer state finance, it's not a question of political will, it's not a question of economics, and it's not a question of, you know, regular business practice, business environment, business conditions, and the real private sector questions begin to pop up. And for us to be able to attract more of these investment from China into our SMEs, the private sector questions need to be addressed. For instance, the global, you know, climate now, and with the war and all of uncertainties with the global economy, it's not necessarily encouraging or very conducive for big investments, you know, you know, overseas. So that is still an issue that the world really needs to not just the world, but even within the China Africa relationship, we need to take into cognizance. So we still believe, and I still believe, that we would see these investments coming, especially in tech, in fintech, because, you know, there's digital Silk Road. I'm sure you are aware of that. That is, you know, the information on digital economic part of the Belt and Road Initiative. And given the markets and the youth population in Africa, and their hunger for data, their hunger for, you know, for devices and apps and all of the, and, you know, these area has a lot of growth potential. So the internet penetration is still very low. So I'm very confident that we'll see a lot of activity in this particular in this sector, you know, going forward, even agriculture as well, going forward. So let's continue to look at we're months into the Dakar Action Plan. So even also climate finance, investment into climate related projects as well. So I think there's a lot of climate related startups here on the continent. It could be energy, it could be water purification. There's so many areas and potential areas for cooperation and attractive to investors. So I think we'll just keep our fingers crossed and keep looking and hoping that the international environment is conducive, and then these proposals or these business opportunities are taken up.
Awesome. Ovigwe, thank you. Thank you so much for the time. I know we've gone way over, but I was enjoying this conversation so much. So forgive me for capturing you, but it's been such an insightful one. Thank you for making the time to do this.
Yes, thank you very much for inviting me.
First of many to come.
Yeah, of course. Anytime.
All right. Thank you so much and have a wonderful rest of the day. Stay in touch.
That brings us to the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. I love learning new things. Hey, if you enjoyed this chat, you definitely enjoy others that came before it. Check out previous episodes on whichever platform you're tuned into now, or visit our website www.thebrenthurstfoundation.org for other episodes. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if I could make one last ask of you, please do share this with others. Again, you're listening to Marie Noel on the Brenthurst Foundation podcast, and it's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Until next week, stay well.